brought to you by Black Knight. It's the technology.ie podcast, episode 36 for Friday, July 20th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichon. Dias Marivagas, Kith Foltrovishtak. Hello and welcome to technology.ie, the podcast. This is Conor Muinichon here with you, and I'm joined as usual by Michaela Nealon. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Conor. How's it going?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad.
It's been a while. You were on your holidays. How did that go?
Very well. I was off in beautiful Montenegro, taking in the sun and the sand, and just taking it easy, basically.
Very good. So you're back to work, and it's all systems go at Black Knight, is it?
Oh, of course, of course.
Very good. It's a kind of, I suppose, midsummer sort of a vibe to the podcast this week. You get into those weeks in sort of mid, late July, and I think it's hard to track people down. People are gone off on their holidays or wherever it might be. I'll be going away for a week in August as well, so there's probably going to be a break enforced then as well. But we'll get down to it. We've a few things to talk about, including some stuff in relation to Black Knight as well. You guys have been busy. You've introduced new products, new features, and you've got some interesting statistics on Black Knight's scores in terms of leading the pack in relation to internet service providers and hosting providers, I should say, and domain providers in Ireland. We'll find out about that Groupon voucher competition we ran on technology.ie. Lots of other news in the tech news this week, in fact, in the last 2 weeks. I'm just going to pick something at random here, and it's not top of our list here, but it's something that you had come up with, Michaela. Apple must publish a notice that Samsung didn't copy the iPad in the UK. You've linked to a story on Bloomberg.
Yeah, I mean, this one is, I think we've talked about a little bit about this in the past, and it's one of those things that's being talked about in technology circles for months. Mm. I mean, this entire thing about Apple trying to make out that Samsung was in breach of its patents and copyright and everything else. And, you know, there's been various battles going on around, you know, various mobile devices and patents involving several companies, not just Apple and Samsung. And, well, they lost in the UK. But not only did they lose, it's one of those decisions which is saying that they have to actually publish a notice to say that Samsung didn't copy them. So I thought that was kind of, that landed in my inbox or something early this morning, and I thought to myself, that's kind of amusing.
Is that sort of a slap on the knuckles for them, saying they have to publish an ad, essentially, publish a notice on their UK website and in British newspapers alerting people to this ruling by the court in the UK that Samsung Electronics didn't copy designs for the iPad? It's an unusual kind of an order to make, really, isn't it? I mean, I would simply imagine that a judge would say, OK, they didn't copy you, no damages to be paid, no injunctions against sale of their product. This sounds a little bit like the judge is giving, I don't know, it's almost a kind of a punitive sort of a ruling, isn't it? And saying Apple.
It's not the first time this kind of judgment has been handed down. I mean, there was judgments against Google for, I think it was in relation to Google News, because they were aggregating newspaper content without some of the newspaper's permission, and they got quite upset about it in the case a couple of years back. So, I mean, yeah, it is a bit of a slap on the wrists, but it's just nice to see that, you know, some of these kind of patent trolling type things that go on, that, you know, judges sometimes will say, enough already.
Enough already. I have ruled on this. Not only that, but I insist that you publicise my ruling. Apple aren't happy about it. One of their lawyers in Cupertino said, no company likes to refer to a rival on its website. The order means that Apple will have to publish an ad for Samsung, is one way that they view it. But I notice as well that this is the same ruling, isn't it, that said the judge included in his ruling the opinion that Samsung didn't copy Apple because the Samsung products aren't as cool as Apple's.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, that doesn't really matter whether he said that or not. I mean, the thing is,
it's unusual. It's unusual language, though, in a legal opinion, isn't it? I mean, what is the legal definition of cool?
I'm not a lawyer, neither are you. let's just leave it at say that.
Yeah.
It's one of those cases where, two tech giants fight it out and one of them loses. And not only do they lose, but they're being forced to lose in a very public fashion.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with you. I just think it's interesting in relation to this idea of something being described by a judge as cool, that whole notion of coolness being used as a basis for a judgment. And, in a way, it's a kind of a compliment to Apple to say, well, they didn't copy you because they're not as cool as you. And the if they had copied from you, then their product would be as cool as yours. But as you say, let's move on. From it. The patent wars continue internationally in different markets, and this is just the latest battle in an ongoing war in the UK courts, and we'll find out more about that no doubt as things go on as well. What else is on the news this week? The death of Dig, I described it. Is that over reaction on my part? I know people are kind of saying that
you're going a little bit too far. Yeah. I mean, it's not really death, it's more of a movement, a sideways movement, I suppose.
We're talking about dig.com, DIGG.com, the social news site, and one of the leaders and the pioneers, I suppose, in that. There are other sites like Reddit and that as well. It's the site that, I suppose, popularised the whole idea of the readers of the news being the people who rank it and being the people who decide which stories go on the front page. It was one of the darlings, I suppose, of the Web 2.0 startup scene in Silicon Valley, and I suppose it's not fair to say that that Dig is dead as such, but it has been, from the point of view of the investment that was made in it, it's been sold, it's been bought out, and it's been kind of broken up and sold to different people, as I understand it, to different companies. Different companies have bought different parts of it, including the intellectual property. Some people have bought the staff, and some people have bought, I think, the final site, isn't that it?
Well, this is it. I mean, it's News.me will be folding in a lot of the Dig stuff into their systems at some point over the next few months. So the guys in .me are absolutely delighted, I'd say, with this one, because it's another big move into a .me domain name away from a .com.
Right.
But I mean, you know, it's not what's more interesting in many respects is the valuations.
Mm.
Because if you look at the Wikipedia article that you linked to there, saying that the brand, website, and technology were sold for $500,000.
Yes.
Now, that is a tiny, tiny, tiny sum compared to money they were talking about only a couple of years ago.
It is, yeah. And that same article says that the company took part in July 2008. The company took part in advanced acquisition talks with Google for a reported $200 million price tag, but the deal ultimately fell through. And what's happened now is that Dig has been essentially sold in three parts. As you say, the brand, website, and technology sold to BetaWorks for $500,000. 15 staff were transferred to the Washington Post's social code for $12 million, which seems to be the bulk of what's been recovered by the investors in this. And then a suite of patents were sold as well to LinkedIn for around $4 million. Interesting. I wonder what exactly was in those patents. But it was definitely, as we say, one of the cheerleaders, or one of the sites that was, I suppose, most talked about, or talked about an awful lot in terms of social, I suppose, Web 2.0 startups and things like that. Going back just a few years, Kevin Rose, the founder, was a kind of a rock star among the tech community in a way, and got his picture on the cover of Newsweek, I think, at an early stage of all of this. And he's actually exited a while back, if I recall. He's come and gone from it. I think he spent a while as CEO there recently, but he in fact has gone to Google, and he's working as a VC in a VC arm of Google. Had you come across that?
Yeah, I mean, he's moved around quite a bit. I mean, Kevin Rose has moved. I mean, if you have a look at his Wikipedia page, Yeah, I mean, he started with Google.
Yeah, he's been involved in a number of startups. In fact, he appears to have, you know, with the early success of Dig and the money that he got from that, he appears to have invested in a lot of startups, a lot of very early stage things that happened in Silicon Valley there as well. But I don't know, it wasn't a site that I ever found. You know, we've talked about this on technology.ie before, Michele. There are some things out there that we get. There are some things, for example, I don't use but I appreciate, such as Pinterest. And I think Dig is a little bit like that as well, in the sense that I could see what was cool about it, but I never felt exactly compelled to go and use it myself. Occasionally, if I had something I wanted to plug or promote, I'd go and give it a dig over on Dig, but that's about as far as it would go. Although I understand that the notion of promoting yourself on Dig and on getting a story dug on Dig and trying to game the system over on Dig, that kind of became a bit of an industry, and some people sort of specialised in that as well, didn't they?
Oh yeah, I mean, Dig, you know, that was the thing. I mean, Dig, Reddit, and there's a few other ones, StumbleUpon's another one, where, you know, it's if you can get a story up there, you know, you will get a huge amount of traffic very, very quickly. I mean, I'm looking at the front page now, though. I mean, the number of digs on the top stories is pretty small compared to the kind of volumes you'd have got a few years back. I mean, a few years back, you'd have been looking at stories getting thousands of votes. I mean, as in if voted up, as it were.
Again, I suppose from the point of view of people who have websites and who want to promote, we want to promote our content. It's interesting to see that maybe the Dig button isn't as popular as it used to be. We don't have it on technology.ie. I've just been looking there as well. We've got Twitter, Facebook, Google+, LinkedIn. Did we have Dig buttons at any stage? No.
No, I never bothered having them.
Yeah, but again, you see, it's a question of whether it was even worth the trouble, from that point of view. And I understand the site has kind of got respectable enough traffic all the same, but whether or not it's something that has the kind of traction, I suppose, that it could have. Obviously, it doesn't. If you add up all of the different amounts that have been paid for the different elements of Dig there, which we referred to in that article on Wikipedia, as we say, it comes to about $16.5 million, a fraction of the, I think, something like $45 million that was invested into it. So the question is, was it a failure?
Well, you know, what's a failure? What's a success? I mean, the thing is, I mean, whoever was involved with it originally, I mean, not just Kevin Rose. I mean, all these guys, they made a lot of money. They did very well.
Yeah.
Other people who used the site over the years did very well as a result of the traffic they were getting from it. I mean, there's, you know, Reddit took over. But, you know, it's the same with some of the social networks. I mean, Bebo was huge a couple of years ago, and then it was sold off there recently, like in a fire sale price.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned, Bebo. That's a great example of how these kind of social sites and these things which depend, I suppose, on where the crowd is looking, what the trend is at the moment, they go off the boil pretty quickly, Michele, don't they? The comparison with what Dig eventually sold for and what it was rumoured to be valued when Google were looking at it a few years back. Bebo, yet another great example there. The Bebo founders couldn't have been more lucky, could they? I mean, they sold out to whom? Who was it bought Bebo in the end? We can't quite remember, but I know they paid enough for it.
I can't remember who was the last buyers. Was it AOL at one stage?
I think it was AOL that paid the Bebo founders, I think, and early investors a large amount of money for Bebo. And I remember the Silicon Valley tech news people at the time going, what the hell is Bebo? Because nobody was using it over there, even though it was huge in Ireland and Britain. But it rapidly lost its shine after that, I think, and as you point out, was basically sold off in a fire sale not too long, within a year or two after that.
Well, I mean, but this is the thing with some of these things. I mean, there, you know, there's a valuation is put on a site or on a service, and in many respects, those valuations are probably completely inflated. But, you know, hey, if you're the person who's picking up the check, are you going to complain?
Well, I suppose that those valuations are valid, but only if certain things hold true, and the world as it is right now goes in the direction you hope it will go in the next 6 months or even 6 weeks. But there's a lot of ifs in relation to this. There's a lot of speculation in the world of early stage investment and investment, especially into these kind of Web 2.0 companies. So it's not something which is very straightforward indeed. But it's good to report, and it's interesting to watch without a doubt. Did you follow this DNS changer story? They were afraid, was it the week before last, I think they were saying that the internet was going to get loads of people, hundreds, millions of people worldwide were going to find out that were at risk of discovering that their internet didn't work all of a sudden when the FBI turned off these servers. Can you bring us back to the start of this? This was a botnet. This was a network of PCs, private computers around the world, which were infected by malware, which had the effect of, what was it, sending them to fake DNS servers. Was that it? And the FBI discovered it.
Yeah, I mean, that the basic thing was that if your computer was infected with the malware, then your DNS would be hijacked.
Okay,
and that meant that they could basically send you wherever they wanted, and you wouldn't know.
So I could ask to go to blackknight.com, for example, and it could send me to a fake blackknight.com, or I could ask to go to my bank, for example, it could send me to a fake site for that as well.
Well, it could send you anywhere. I mean, if I control your DNS on your computer, in other words, how your computer decides where, let's say, technology.ie is, which server it's on, all that kind of thing. If I'm able to take control of that, I can send you wherever. I could send you to playboy.com instead of technology.ie, and you wouldn't know. I
mean, and that's what these people were doing, isn't it? They were, I suppose, spoofing or misdirecting DNS lookup requests to other sites, other servers, which they controlled, and they were making money then from page impressions for ads and things like that, and clicks.
That's the kind of general way these things work. I mean, but the thing with this was that it was all going to happen on a particular day.
Okay.
It's a specific. I'm just actually trying to find you the exact name of the botnet.
Well, my understanding was that the authorities discovered this site, and instead of shutting it down, they said, "Well, hang on, if we shut this down, all of these infected computers won't be able to access DNS, because as well as sending you to these fake sites, obviously this was, to all intents and purposes, for the infected computers. This was where they were going for DNS. This was their only source of legitimate DNS information, as well as illegitimate stuff. Isn't that it? So the authorities decided to now. This is the bit I don't get. The authorities decided to leave it up and running for a while, rather than cause a shock to that many number of potentially infected users. Was that the case, or was that what it was about?
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea was that this is all going back to like November of last year, or thereabouts. So I mean, I can send you a couple of links we can include in the show notes.
Great.
Like the U.S. Department of Justice, they found a massive scam ring, and the malware, which is called DNS Changer. So originally they thought it infected, what was it, about 4 million computers in more than 100 countries.
Right.
So like the idea being that the malware would hijack the computer when certain web searches were done, redirect them to sites that would pay them money when people visited or clicked on ads.
Yeah.
That's the basic thing. So, you know, you're hijacking people's DNS so you can send them wherever.
Yeah.
Depending on certain actions. I mean, you could... It's actually the kind of it's one of the worst thing, one of the biggest nightmares you could have. I mean, if you remember, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Aircom had an issue where their DNS was impacted by something similar. So people were reporting, you know, my website's not working or my internet's not working. You know, I'm trying to get to website X and I'm being sent to website Y and all this kind of thing. So the FBI basically. From what I can gather, they managed to seize control of a lot of this stuff and made a number of arrests. So a lot of the security companies, domain registries, ISPs, started promoting services so that people could check their computers to make sure that they weren't infected. Mm. And if they were infected, you know, remove the infection.
So in that intermediate period between them discovering this network, taking control of these DNS servers which these guys had set up, and actually ultimately shutting it down, that interval, that period was used to I suppose to run an information campaign to work with internet service providers and others to try and make sure that computers that were infected could get deinfected. And so when it eventually did get turned off last week, there didn't seem to be any major outcry. People didn't suddenly discover that their DNS wasn't working. And if they did, it didn't take much to fix it. I presume it was simply a case of going in and editing your DNS settings.
Well, it wouldn't have been that. You'd have to remove the malware itself.
Of course.
It would be an infection. So, I mean, if people had proper antivirus and everything else on their computers, they probably wouldn't have been impacted to begin with. But, of course, as we all know, a lot of people, unfortunately... Right. You know, don't.
So I guess if you were in that situation and you suddenly discovered that it wasn't working, you'd pick up the phone and you'd ring your internet service provider and they'd say, hang on a second, get some antivirus, go to this IP address or something, get some antivirus and then we'll sort you out, kind of thing. Wasn't that it?
Well, I mean, the thing was, you know, there was plenty of advance warning. Google and several others ran programs to... you know, let people know what was going on and what to do and all this kind of thing. So, you know, in the end, you know, people would have been impacted, but not as many as could have been impacted.
Let's move on. We go to the technology.ie website, Michele. You've posted a link to something called Trust Me, I'm Lying. It's a trailer for a book.
Yes.
Explain, please.
Well, I think what we'll do is actually just let's just play a couple of seconds of the video because I think it actually explains it very, very well.
The internet is full of liars, cheats, and charlatans who want only one thing: your attention. Page views and publicity control what you think you know. The stories on the internet, the news on TV. The system is completely defenseless. Manipulators like me spread lies.
I mean, basically, I don't know if the audio came through clearly on that or not.
It did, loud and clear. And what I'll do is I'll re-edit the podcast to include the clear audio at this end as well. Go ahead anyway, yes?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the guy behind this book, Ryan Holiday, he works for American Apparel in the US, but he also does stuff for other companies. And the book is in two parts. The first part... he explores how the media is manipulated and how to manipulate the media. So it's, you know, the simple kind of concept would be you can make a news story reach the likes of CNN or BBC or The Guardian or, you know, some really well-respected news source by simply seeding things much lower down the food chain.
Okay, so this guy is an expert at this kind of, what would you call it, media manipulation, he describes it. He says, Trust Me, I'm Lying. The book title is Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. And what he's saying is, this is what I do, and I'm showing you my secret. He's a little bit like a magician saying, don't believe in psychics, it's all fake. And he's saying, don't believe everything you read in the paper because it's manipulated by people like me.
Well, it's not just the paper, it's blogs, yeah, it's mainstream media. And, you know, it's fascinating because he goes through some various case studies of, you know, films, of other stories that were put out in the media. Mm. And, you know, in some cases it wasn't true at all, or in other cases it kind of manufactured and manipulated the story to make a non-story into a story. Mm.
So have you bought the book and read it, Michele?
Well, I was sent an advance copy by the publisher.
Okay.
And a couple of weeks ago. So
does it live up to the hype?
Sorry,
does it live up to the hype?
Oh, totally. It's an absolutely fantastic read. I'm about three quarters of the way through it, and if I wasn't talking to you or doing other things, I'd probably be reading it. Now, it's a very, very gripping read. And if you're interested in how the media works, if you work in the online media space at any level, be that as a blog, you know, blogging, using Facebook, Twitter, other social media, you know, if you're even just consuming stuff, you know, he goes into a lot of the techniques and the drivers behind a lot of these big sites. I mean, one of the things that I always found a little bit overwhelming when you're looking at, say, the likes of TechCrunch or Mashable, was the sheer volume of content that they're pumping out every day.
Yeah.
Which I thought, you know, it got to a certain point and I was like, you know, this is just too much. There's no way I can keep up. So I stopped trying. And, you know, he explains, you know, why is it that these sites are pumping out so much content and why also the quality of the content is so incredibly low. You know, that if you look at any of these big blogs, they're pumping out stories really, really quickly. Most of their writers are quite badly paid. It's all to do with page views.
And they're getting 7-8 per writer, 7-8 or more, 10, 12 blog posts a day out of some of these.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there's different...
You couldn't read it that fast, not to mind write.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, if you look at the way some of these sites break stories, you'll see that, you know, that, like, say for example with Apple, when Apple has one of their big show and reveal type things, some new product or whatever, you see a lot of these sites running live blogs, and they're just typing the stuff in really, really fast as it happens, and there's no real commentary. It's more going to be kind of ooh ah, look what they've done now type of thing.
We've got that in Ireland now, haven't we? With sites as well. And I noticed there is this say with sites like the journal.ie and sites like that. There's a whole rush of new blog news sites. There's sites like joe.ie. There's all of these sites that start to show up now when I look for when I search for things at Google. A lot of the stuff comes up in sites like this, and it can be, like you say, an awful lot of blog posts in one day, an awful lot from one writer, some of them very short, not much in some of them at all, others indeed, and let's give credit where it's due, there's a lot of quality in there as well. But they all seem to be mindful, like you say, of this publish early and often and keep getting the content out there. What does this do? I want to talk in a minute about how you can manipulate this, and how you can, if you are somebody like Ryan Holiday and you want to get your story published, you want to get your whatever it is that you're promoting being talked about. I want to talk in a moment about that. But first of all, from the point of view of the publishers, from the point of view of sites like TechCrunch and those who publish in this fashion, what are they getting out of it, Michele? Why do they publish like this?
Page views.
So the more you publish, the more page views you get, the more hits you're likely to get on different keyword searches and things like that.
Well, if you look at the way they're constructing, let's say, for example, I'm just going to go to Mashable.
Sure. So you're saying the more pages you publish, the more page views you get.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's say, for example, looking at the front page of Mashable at the moment, Dark Knight Rises, obviously there's going to be one or two stories about that. So, I mean, some of the articles probably do go into a certain amount of depth, but, you know, a lot of them, you know, quick, catchy title, and let's see, this article has probably 200 words, maybe? And most of the articles on there are going to be that kind of length. They're short. They may not have anything that original in there, but you know, it's, you know, you click through, you generate a page view, you click back to the home page, you've generated another page view. They're selling the advertising based on the number of page views they're getting.
Is that actual real value for advertisers, or is it just smoke and mirrors?
Yeah, hard one to say. I mean, it's, you know, I advertise as well, and you know, it's very, very hard to say how much value you're getting.
Well, I suppose at the end of the day, it breaks down to a certain amount of uniques, and the more different, basically, the more different unique URLs you put out there, the better a chance you have of getting unique viewers to come and view those. I suppose, Michaela, I like talking to you about this stuff because, as you say, you're an advertiser, you're a business person, you're a publisher, you're a blogger, you're a social media manipulator yourself. You're also an old school blogger, as I know you as well. So you've seen this grow over the years, and the likes of the individual bloggers and the small community of bloggers, I suppose, that would have grown over the last 10, 12 years or so. I mean, we didn't start blogging like this. We might put out a post a day or something like this. But I know that nowadays, Michele, you're kind of sophisticated about it, and you have certain sites that you blog certain specialized topics on, and you do dabble in this kind of publish a lot short, quick posts, for example, photographs of beautiful women and things like that as well. You have sites dedicated to various things that people might be worth a Google or two.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't consider myself to be any way successful. I mean,
no, but I'm saying, and the reason I'm asking you is that I know that it's not your main business, and you dabble in this, I suppose, would be a way to put it. But do you get an insight from being someone who publishes in this way? Do you get an insight into how this could be successful from the point of view of somebody who rolled up their sleeves and went at it seriously?
Well, yeah, I mean, the certain things that just make sense. I mean, you take, say, let's say, okay, famous actors, actresses, films, celebrities, basically. Mm. Celebrities sell. They sell in huge numbers, in huge volumes. Mm. So, like, looking at the statistics on some sites, you know, you can see. You post something with, say, Jessica Alba or Brooklyn Decker or Eva Mendes, you know, they're going to get a certain amount of traffic.
Indeed. I'm sitting up in my chair already.
Yeah, of course you are.
Yes.
It's the same with, you know, certain films, other stuff in the popular pop culture. Mm. I mean, if you look at when we were talking to Patrick Rudell about sciencefiction.com,
yeah,
I mean, sites like that live on this. I mean, this is how they get their traffic. Now, I wouldn't be able to compete with these guys. I mean, they're pumping out multiple articles every day. Mm-hmm. But I mean, just looking at some of the search queries that I get on some sites here, like, you know, The Hangover is still getting traffic months after the last film came out. And you'll see spikes, you know, if the DVD comes out or the Blu-ray comes out, or if a film wins an award or one of the actors is in the news, you'll see traffic going to it. But I mean, this isn't really what Ryan's holiday stuff is talking about. It's all about things like, say, for example, you want to get a small film with a very low budget and you want to make that newsworthy, and you can't afford to spend millions on advertising. You know, how do you get the big sites to talk about your film? And you know, the answer is, you know, controversy.
Right.
Make it controversial, even if it isn't. You know, is there some kind of scandal you can generate around something? I mean, you know, we've even done it in the past ourselves. You know, we put out something kind of slightly provocative.
No.
And obviously, you look at, say, at GoDaddy. I mean, GoDaddy with their Super Bowl stuff. I mean, that's how they made a lot of money originally, was by putting out very provocative ads.
It's certainly how a lot of people heard about them, I suppose, in many respects. And yeah, I get what you're saying in relation to that. But that, Michaela, that's old school PR. I mean, that's the whole no such thing as bad publicity thing. There's nothing new here.
Well, there is, because in if you look at traditional media, there's a certain degree of, you know, fact checking. So, you know, you take, say, for example, Adrian from the Sunday Business Post, who we had on a few months back. Adrian isn't going to go off and publish an article unless he's actually checked the facts.
Right.
It's the same with any of the other print media. But they'll do some basic fact checking. They'll make sure that, you know, the person actually said something or did whatever it was, or that they're actually authorized, you know, there's something there, there's some truth to it.
So what Ryan Holiday is saying is that this kind of reputable news organization and the way they work, that's really in the minority now in terms of what people can get online, or what the kind of news consumption people do online, and that your average careless page impression devoted blogger is just going to publish almost whatever you give him, and he'll be as happy, he'll be grateful for the page views just as you are grateful for the publicity. And in doing so, there's a whole new...
Well, there's more to it than that, because...
Do go on.
The kind of thing is this, is that, let's say, for example, you have a blog, right? And somebody sends you an exclusive story.
Mm.
And you're like, ooh, excellent, wow, I've got an exclusive story. So you publish it in good faith. But your blog's small, you don't have that much traffic. But it's picked up by somebody further up the food chain with more traffic, and they'll use your blog article as a basis for theirs, and then it moves up the chain. So this is the thing, is that you can seed something low down and get it up the food chain fairly quickly, because everybody's just going to refer to everybody else. They're not actually going to go off and do any original research or actually check to see whether it's actually true or not.
Ah, and the fact that it was published by such and such a blog means that others will pick up on it, and they won't, you know, they'll assume that, well, they won't assume, they won't even much care whether or not it was fact-checked in the first place. And they're just saying, such and such a site out there is reporting X, and what you've done, so you're starting a rumour, really, is what you're doing, Michele, isn't it? It's kind of, if you get a, you know, it's the old story of bad news travels fast, or if the story is attractive enough or salacious enough or whatever, it will take off and run all by itself. It's gossip, Michele. That's what it is.
Well, there's a certain degree of that. But I mean, look, the thing is, what I say is, you know, what Ryan's thing is, you know, the first part is all about how you kind of seed stories, how you kind of manipulate it, what kind of drives all these things. But then the second part of it is, you know, the nasty side of all this, you know, how a blog post or two can put a business out of business. I mean, how you can bankrupt somebody, how you can damage somebody's reputation, even if it's not true. I mean, the story might have a grain of truth, but just complete twisting and manipulating of things just to get more page views, you end up doing a lot of damage.
It sounds like we have, I mean, I know we say that the antidote to this is take everything you read online with a grain of salt, but we've ended up with, and I know a lot of people have called for regulation of online media and bloggers and stuff like that. That's impossible for a start, and not exactly desirable in terms of what the ultimate effect it would have. I guess, is it buyer beware, Michele? Is there a lesson in this, or have you got that far in the book yet?
I don't think there is an actual... I don't think I'm going to find any any huge lesson that's going to change my life or anything. But I think, at the same time, it's a bit of an eye-opener, because, you know, some of the stuff you might be aware of if you're interested in media and
And if you play with it yourself, you probably use some of the techniques in your own way at some level.
Mm.
But I suppose it's the kind of thing where, you know, it's just a bit of an eye-opener to see, you know, how twisting a story around a bit, and even, like, say, for example, there was one story where a nasty rumour led to a big story. That story got something like, say, 500,000 page views, and the retraction or correction only got about 20,000.
Mm.
So even though a retraction may have been published, nobody saw it.
It's the book is called, what's it called again? I had it there. Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. Maybe we'll get him on the show, Michele. What do you think?
If we can, it would be great. I think he's an interesting character, but based on what I've seen over the last couple of days, I'd say he's going to be in a lot of demand as the story... as the book was just released in the States today.
Okay, well, we're going to find out more about that, and I think we're going to, like you say, I imagine it's going to be very attractive to mainstream media. It's probably the kind of thing you'll hear Pat Kenny talking about in the next few days as well. What else is there? Here's another example of media manipulation. A website called ArcticReady.com, and when you go to it, I came up with this one this week, Michele. Somebody I saw the other day was tweeting about it on Twitter. And when you go to ArcticReady.com, it looks like it's a kind of proper propaganda website on behalf of Shell, the oil company. But you start to realise that it's actually, if it is, it's a very strange publicity campaign. It says that it's all about, it's a website kind of designed to cheerlead and encourage the exploration for oil in the Arctic. The whole idea behind it is the Arctic is melting, global warming is changing the planet, and how do they say, for hundreds of years explorers have battled the Arctic. Today we're finally winning. We've all heard about global climate change and the challenges it brings, especially to the most vulnerable among us. And then it goes on and on and on in relation to that. But it says that basically not only is climate change a challenge, but it also has tremendous opportunities. And what's the biggest opportunity we've got today? The melting Arctic. And that's, I think, at some point, if you haven't realised at this stage, three or four paragraphs into it, that's when you realise this is kind of tongue-in-cheek. But as I was saying to you, Michele, there are probably, it's so cleverly designed that I imagine there is a certain constituency of climate change denying, energy exploration cheerleading people who would say, yeah, hell yeah, go for it, you know. Let's melt the Arctic and see what's there.
Well, yeah, this is the funny thing. I mean, I've seen links for this site floating around over the last few days. And while some people obviously knew it was a spoof, yeah, others thought it was genuine.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I thought was absolutely hilarious. Because if you go into the site, there's a section, Let's Go Social.
Yeah, I'm looking. Oh, here it is. Yeah, and this is where they've invited the public, and it looks like a kind of a campaign thing. All right, it's an ad generator. They've invited the public to choose from a selection of images and to come up with a caption to go with them. So there's a picture of an Arctic fox. There's a picture of some Arctic bird life. There's a picture of some fish. There's a good few polar bears and whales in there as well. And then they've invited people, as we say, to for example, there's a picture of an oil rig against a backdrop of an icy landscape, and it says the caption someone, by the way, has come up with is "Turn the power on, it's time to melt some ice." And the next one I think is particularly good, the picture of the Arctic fox, and it says "You can't run your SUV on cute," and
there's hundreds of them there. I mean, another one with the oil rig, if we monitor our drills like we do our websites, we're going to be fine. Let's go.
Yeah, yeah. And there was another one in relation to spill prevention or something. BP didn't need to worry about it or something. Or a spill plan or something like that. Yeah, no, it's very clever, and it's absolute satire, and it's biting satire is what it is, really. It kind of reminds me of Jonathan Swift and his his modest proposal, for example, to suggest that perhaps the British government in Ireland ought to encourage the Irish people to rear their children for sale to be slaughtered and served as meat. In that famous example of that. But it's in the same vein, I think, of this kind of thing as well. You can check it out at arcticready.com. What else are we going to talk?
It's actually run by Greenpeace, by the way.
Oh, it is it? Very clever, very well done. I wasn't clear. It wasn't immediately apparent who was actually behind it. We want to talk about the hotline, hotline.ie. I'm going to talk about that in part two. And I also want to talk in part two about something called CaraPay, which is in private beta at the moment. Michaela, you'll be able to tell us a bit more about it. It's an initiative from Realex, which, of course, is the Irish payment company. But first, what's this? Flickr.com/dearinternet. What is that?
Well, Flickr has, I don't know, how can I put this? Personally, I love Flickr. I've been using it for years, and I all my photos end up posted on Flickr at some stage.
Yeah.
But it's one of those sites that, you know, a lot of people have felt, you know, it's...
There's been almost no development in it in the last, I would say, 5 years. Would it be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's kind of, it's been very, very stagnant. I mean, they've added a few features, but very little compared to what other sites have done. And I don't know when this was put out, but I just saw it going around earlier this evening. So it's, if you go to flickr.com/dearinternet.
And it says, the page says, "Dear Internet, thanks. Come help us make Flickr awesomer." And then there's a link to flickr.com/jobs, and it says heart Flickr, love Flickr, and a hashtag Dear Internet. What's this about, Michele?
Well, I think it's just what they're trying to do is just get people interested in working for Flickr, and let's, you know, rejuvenate Flickr. Mm. So, you know, they've got a new CEO over in Yahoo, who joined earlier this week.
Oh, that's right. Marissa Meyer, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Formerly of Google.
That's right, and has been really one of the leading lights at Google. And that, in fact, that news, I only just saw that very briefly this evening. That's an interesting appointment, it's kind of encouraging, I think, from the point of view of Yahoo in general. Or what would you be your take on that?
Well, I mean, the thing with Yahoo is, I mean, they've had... It's, you know, Yahoo is one of the original mega sites. I mean, it was one of the first sites that we all visited when we first started playing around with the internet back in the 90s. It's gone through so many different iterations over the years.
And it's gone through so many CEOs over the last few years as well. And in fact, even recently I heard that some candidates who were approached said, wouldn't touch it with a barge pole.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those companies that's, it's, you know, it they plugged away for years, but they've been, you know, falling behind in terms of innovation, whereas other companies, you know, they're constantly innovating, constantly coming up with new and funky products and services. Yahoo had lots and lots of problems.
It's not like Yahoo haven't tried, and there have been initiatives such as the Yahoo Brickhouse, and I fail at the moment to think of anything which came out of that, but I know that it was very interesting, very exciting at the time, and if I recall correctly, there were, it was like a startup incubator inside, located inside Yahoo, and some interesting things, I can't name one of them right now, but I know some interesting things did come out of it. They've made various efforts over the last few years to be innovative, and at the same time have bought companies like Flickr and then let them stagnate effectively. So would you say that perhaps, would you be hopeful, Michaela, that they maybe have got it right this time, or maybe able to not so much initiate some kind of rejuvenation, but sustain it, which seems to be their problem?
Well, you know, the thing, as long as Flickr keeps working, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I like Flickr, I use Flickr, and if Flickr were to go away, I would be very upset. I mean, I don't get as het up about, you know, what's happening with Yahoo and everything else, but, you know, there are companies been around for since the beginning in terms of internet terms, and, you know, maybe under new leadership, things will change dramatically. Who knows?
It'll be interesting to see. And in a way, I suppose, Michele, you're fond of Flickr. You like it. You have your community there. You like what it does with your photographs. In a way, you really don't want it to change much, do you?
Well, if they want to make it better, fine.
Yeah.
I mean, if they, I just hope they don't do like Dig did with, you know, an iteration of their software about 2 years ago, which completely broke it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's it. It works very well now. I just hope that they don't go over innovating and breaking it in the process.
Let's talk about you, Michele. Enough about other things. Let's talk about not so much about you, but about your company, about Black Knight, sponsors of technology.ie. And of course, we've taken a break on the podcast now for 2 weeks while you were on your holidays. And we've missed a couple of things. You've announced some new things, starting with Who is Privacy. You can now have that with Black Knight registered domains. Is that right?
Yeah, we launched that initially. It's available for .com and .net domain registrations. So it means that if you buy the Who is Privacy service from us when you're registering a .com or a .net, your personal contact details won't appear in Who is. So they'll be replaced with something else. So I've actually, up on the blog post there, I've put up an example of what that would look like. So everything would go to be care of Who is Privacy Limited.
Okay.
So it just means that, you know, that it because one of the problems people have is that Who is publishes for Comnet, Org, InfoBiz, and other GTLDs. You know, a lot of your details get put up online in Who is, and you know, for companies that shouldn't be an issue, but for private individuals that can be a problem if they don't want people, you know, ringing them on their mobile numbers and things like that. So it just provides a little bit of extra protection to people.
Fair enough. And you're not charging a whole lot for this either.
No, I mean, it's $4.99 a year for a domain, which, I, you know, it's a reasonable price. I mean, ultimately, from our perspective as the service provider for this, we're the ones who are going to get hit with the initial legal threats and everything else if somebody misbehaves when they're using the service. But, you know, the service is designed in such a way that, you know, it's not to be used and abused by people who want to infringe copyright or do other kind of nasty things online. We're aiming this more at private individuals who don't want to publish their personal contact details online.
Fair enough. And the other thing which is of interest and came out this week is the recent Hoster Stats report, which says some nice things about Black Knight in terms of the hosting and domain industry in Ireland as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, we've been the number one hosting provider in Ireland for the last couple of years, and you know, as a domain registrar, we register thousands of domains every month for companies all over the world. It's just, you know, the Hoster Stats reports, it's third party, it's completely independent. And we're the first Irish hosting provider to have broken the 100,000 site hosted mark.
Congratulations.
It's still, you know, in terms of the global market, that's not particularly big. But as John McCormack tweeted there last week, Black Knight now hosts more domains than the Irish web hosting industry hosted in 2005.
Which is very significant indeed. There's some interesting pie charts there on that, which people can see, and showing that basically Black Knight is a significant chunk of the Irish web and domain and hosting pie. So well done to you, Michele. And you can find out more about that on blog.blackknight.com. Also, you ran a little Facebook promotion in association with Groupon. If people want to find out more, the results of that are on. Basically, people had to like the page, wasn't it? And if they liked your Facebook page, they were entered into a draw for a Groupon voucher.
Well, there were a couple of ways. You know, you could tweet, you could follow the Black Knight Twitter account, like the technology.ie Facebook page. And, you know, it was just a little bit of fun. And we gave away 4 Groupon vouchers for €50 a pop. You know, it was just all done through the blog there over the course of about a week.
Nice one. So congratulations to those, and if you want to check if you were one of the winners or if you know the winners, you can visit the site at technology.ie.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to Technology.ie, the podcast brought to you by Black Knight. Michaela Nealon is the Black Knight CEO. Hello, Michaela.
Hello, Con.
My name is Con O'Meenachon, and we do this every week usually, and sometimes every 2 weeks. Michaela, you sent me a link this evening to a private beta for something called Carapay, or as a Gaelgor, I would say Carapay. Our friends in Realex are behind this.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Realex have had in the pipeline for the last couple of years. And, you know, Colm, it's something that he's been talking about to people for the last, it must be 2 or 3 years now. Mm. So they finally have launched it, and it's powered by Realex payments, and it's. I don't know, did you get any, I sent you an invite earlier.
So I did, yeah, and it took me a while because obviously you're dealing with payments and things like that, and there's a number of security features, and you have to verify not just your email address, but also your mobile phone number. It sends you out a PIN code to that, and in the end you choose a fairly secure password, and then you're in. I'm in now. Let me see, where did I have it? I have it open in a window here somewhere, and I have... Actually, I'll just sign in here while I'm at it. And yeah, so far so good. I logged in and I discovered that you're in there. You're the person who sent me the invite from it. And there's a list of people. I can maintain a list of people who pay me and a list of people whom I pay as well.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment the service is very beta. I mean, they're only just adding stuff to it. But I mean, the idea would be that it's meant to be a secure way of sending money backwards and forwards, both between individuals and eventually to businesses. So that eventually, I'm not too sure when exactly, that you would, if you had a Carapay account, you'd be able to pay a company like ourselves for, you know, your domain registration or whatever, using this system as an alternative to credit cards or whatever.
As an alternative to something like PayPal, I suppose, in a way, is it? I mean, that's the obvious thing people would think of, that there might be similarities. Would you see those similarities with PayPal, or is this something more? Obviously, we're speculating a little bit here in relation to this because it's not public yet. It's not live yet.
Well, I mean, at the moment, as I say, it's one of those things where. You know, it's not 100% clear what way it's going to.
But there are similarities there, aren't there, in relation to PayPal?
Oh, totally, yeah, totally.
So to what you know, and again, perhaps we've talked before about inviting Colm on technology.ie, Michaela, and probably we should do so in relation to this. But as you understand it, is this going to compete with PayPal, or is it fixing a different problem entirely?
I think it does a couple of things, because if you actually look at your account on there, it actually has a sort code, an account number, a BIC and an IBAN.
Mm.
So it's actually a rootable bank account.
Okay.
It's more than just a virtual, you know, payment system like PayPal, which is linked back to your credit card. This is actually a bank account.
I get it. And it makes the point as well. It says Carapay is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a payments institution. It's like a bank account. I see what you mean.
So, I mean, the thing is this. Let's say, for example, I've sent funds to my account from my AIB account. Mm. I know Paul, my business partner, he's also been playing around with it, and he sent money to his account from his Bank of Ireland account.
Okay.
And depending on which bank you're with, you know, you might be able to get the money in a couple of hours, or it might take a day or two or whatever. But then once you have the funds in there, you're then able to use that to send payments. But the thing I think that this is trying to solve is it's down to micropayments. It's down to, you know, making small payments, a couple of euro here, a couple of euro there. Because that traditionally has been something which is, you know, quite awkward and quite expensive, both for everybody involved. Whereas this, I think this thing is aiming at making that a little bit simpler.
I'm just looking at, I clicked through from the Carapay website and I've gone to their Twitter page and I see a tweet there from them in response to a conversation or questions that they were asked on Twitter. They say, "We are neither Stripe nor PayPal. We'll be providing consumer and business current accounts." So that's interesting. Stripe is something that's been in the news recently as well. Obviously, Michaela, I don't know if you saw that news there recently, but it's valued up somewhere in relation to, they reckon somewhere around $500 million. I think they did their latest Series B round of funding there. Of course, Stripe, founded by they're not teenagers anymore. I think, although I think John might be 19 or possibly, I think they're both into their 20s now. You know, Patrick and John Collison, the two brothers from Limerick who went and they got on, what was it, what did they call it? The Y-Cumulator. They got on the Y-Cumulator program with their first startup, which was Automatic, which was tools for power sellers on eBay. Sold that for a few million between themselves and their business partners on that. They did well out of that. But their latest startup is Stripe, and it's been getting a lot of interest recently, Michaela. Did you see any of that while you were on your holidays?
Well, I hate to say it, but no.
We'll come back and talk about it again, I think. But and again, I'm not sure how it differs or what is particularly different or what people find as particularly interesting about Stripe. But I know that it's something that in particular a lot of startups are using to take payments, to accept payments online. So it's something we'll come back to, I think, again.
Well, I mean, they're looking at this. I mean, Stripe, I mean, again, you know, it's one of those things. It, you know, there's a lot of space in the online payments. I mean, to actually make it easier and make it better and for people to be able to process payments online.
There's a lot of room for improvement, yeah.
Well, I mean, I remember when we first started selling online, the amount of headaches and hassle involved in trying to take credit card payments were massive. I mean, and it took us several years to get to a point where we could actually get a proper merchant account from the bank. And even then, it still has it. There's still issues.
Going back to Carapay, Michaela, do we know anything about when they'll be going, say, to a public beta or a more public kind of a launch in relation to this? Have you any information on that?
Not at the moment, no. I mean, the thing is that the entire project is something. I know it's, from what I know, it's, you know, Cullum's, it's one of Cullum's pet projects. And he's, you know, he's been working on this for several years. But I know that, you know, the regulatory overheads in setting something like this up are massive. So it's taken them a very long time to get it this far. I would hope that they'd be able to get it into something kind of, you know, public within a couple of months. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
And definitely, I think we're going to have to invite Cullum Lyon to join us on the podcast on technology.ie at some stage. We'll get back to that, no doubt, and follow up. I think this whole thing in relation to payments is very, very interesting in these. Finally, Michaela, I wanted to... You've brought to my attention this evening the Hotline annual report. Remind us what the Hotline is, please.
Yeah, OK. Well, Hotline.ie is... it's run by the Irish, by the ISPAI, which is the Internet Service Providers Association of Ireland, which is a horrible name for the organisation, but we happen to be a member. So I have to be reasonably nice about them.
Yeah.
The thing about Hotline is it's one of several. I mean, there's an international association of internet hotlines, which is InHope, and it's all about protecting children online.
And it's been around for a while, and I think people are probably, if not overtly familiar with it, certainly have they will recall it being launched or hearing something about it at some stage. Am I right in saying, Michaela, that the idea is if you find something objectionable or criminal or similar on the internet, that this is a place you can go to complain or to report it?
Yes, but it has to be. What's interesting, and I know this from talking to Paul Durant and others, is, you know, that at the bulk of the reports that they get aren't actually suitable for them, because, you know, just because you don't like something or just because you personally find it objectionable does not mean that it's illegal.
For example, you're talking about, let's say, legal adult pornography and things like that. Some people may find it objectionable, but that doesn't make it criminal.
Exactly. So, you know, if you want to go to, you know, Hustler or Playboy or any, well, I mean, okay, Playboy isn't exactly porn, but some people would have issues with it. You know, you're entitled to do so. It's not breaking any laws. What does break laws is our stuff involving, you know, paedophilia, grooming, and all sorts of other, you know, unpleasantness, in which would, you know, basically be taking advantage of minors online.
Just looking through the latest report here, illegal content covering things such as child pornography, incitement to hatred, child grooming activities, and also financial scams as well are covered by this these criteria as well.
Well, is anything that's actually illegal is the key thing. I mean, the focus for a lot of it has always been, you know, protecting children online. You know, the grooming, of course, is the same thing. That's all to do with, you know, dealing with children. You know, if you talk to Paul or any of the others involved with it, I mean, they do get a huge number of reports every year, which are completely out of scope. But what is interesting is that the actual number, the volume of reports of actual illegal content had dropped in 2011, was 50% down on the previous year.
Now, that's dramatic. If you get a fall of something of over 50% in the previous year, you kind of sit up and say, hang on a second, did we forget a box, or did we leave something after us? You know, have we lost some of these complaints? Or that would be the first thing I would think about. What do they attribute this drop of 50% in reports of illegal content? What do they attribute the drop to?
Well, there's been, if you follow this space at all, there's been quite a few high profile cases over the last 12 to 18 months of these big rings being taken down. Because, I mean, there's huge paedophile rings, and, you know, there's this entire underbelly to the internet, which is, you know, pretty nasty. But, you know, the law enforcement agencies have done very well over the last 12 to 18 months and actually dealing with some of this, and have had some pretty big successes. So, you know, one thought is that, yeah, you know, the reason the reports are down is because people are finding less of this content. That doesn't mean that the content's gone away, but it just means it's harder for somebody to just come across it. You have to really seek it out.
So it's what you would optimistically hope for would be that there's less of the content being reported because more of the bad guys have been arrested and rounded up and taken away. Possibly more likely what you're suggesting is that there's less of the content being reported because the law enforcement activity has led to a scenario or a situation where essentially the bad guys are lying low and maybe not being if they are engaged in this kind of content, they're making it more difficult to find. I suppose in as much as this means the public is less likely to encounter this kind of illegal content online, which of course is part of the problem. There's another problem in that it's, you know, this kind of content online is evidence of a crime and evidence of actual abuse being taken place. And indeed, as we know, the people who perpetrate this perpetrate these crimes in order to have more demand for producing this kind of content. So the display and the exchange of this kind of material actually is something which stimulates this activity as well, and results in, for example, children being abused. So it would be hoped, I suppose, that this 50% drop means that there is a similar drop in abuse as well. This is what we would hope for, isn't it?
Well, I mean, look, the thing is this: if it's harder for people to find it, then we're winning.
That's a good thing. And yeah, I guess.
You know, I mean, that's what it boils down to. But I mean, if you go on to the In Hope site and just have a look at the news sections there, I mean, there's, you know, British paedophile faces jail and deportation, Finnish paedophile busted in Bulgaria, hundreds of paedophiles netted in a global sting. And I see other things as well in other coming to me from other sources about, you know, various wins that law enforcement have had.
There's a section in this very report as well, in the hotline.ie report, a section titled Observations, Trends and Successes, and it refers to illegal content being accessed less often. It refers to specific arrests of individuals and of rings, and there is a hope here that this is actually there seems to be evidence that this, I suppose, increased spotlight on this and the law enforcement activity which results from it is actually leading to a positive trend in relation to this.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I'd hope at some point over the next few weeks or a couple of months that we'd actually be able to get one of the leading law enforcement agents who actually deals with this to come on as a guest. Though, word of warning, he will shock you, because he knows about the nastiest things that people can do online, and what he will tell you, it will scare you. But you know, the thing is, from what I've seen, you know, it's positive that there is, you know, that they are having success. They are able to crack down on these kind of things, and you know, companies are, you know, that support initiatives like hotline.ie are helping to stamp out this kind of activity. And it's the kind of stuff you just don't want.
Absolutely. Well, on that sober note, I think we'll call it a night on this week's edition of technology.ie podcast. Michaela, thanks as always to you for your insight, and I suppose your insider insight into the industry and the contacts that you have as well. And we look forward to following up again with you next week.
Thanks, Colin.
Thanks a lot.